This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Around the world, America's ambassadors are on the front lines. These days, the already challenging job of high-level diplomacy comes with the added complications of terrorism and conflict. Our main focus this hour is the role of American ambassadors today. Later in the program, we'll also speak with the producer of a new documentary film, Kofi Annan, The Center of the Storm. It airs tonight on PBS. But first, two news updates. We'll go first to Chicago, where just in the last hour, President Bush presented his plan to stimulate the economy. And we'll also go to London, where police have arrested five men and found traces of a potential biological weapon. In his address to the Economic Club of Chicago an hour ago, President Bush formally announced a plan that has as its centerpiece the complete elimination of federal income taxes on stock dividends.
It's fair to tax a company's profits. It's not fair to double tax by taxing the shareholder on the same profits. So today, for the good of our senior citizens and to support capital formation across the land, I'm asking the United States Congress to abolish the double taxation of dividends. The benefits of this tax relief will be felt throughout the economy. Abolishing double taxation of dividends will leave nearly 35 million Americans with more of their own money to spend and invest, which will promote savings and return as much as $20 billion this year to the private economy.
Joining us now is Michael Duffy, Washington Bureau Chief and Assistant Managing Editor of Time Magazine. He's with us by phone from his office here in Washington. Good to have you back on the program.
Hi, Neil.
First, let's recap what the President just announced. As we've already said, he wanted Congress to eliminate dividend taxes. What else is in the plan?
He hit very hard the notion that he was going to have three different kinds of tax relief for middle-income families. He was going to speed up and increase the deduction you get for having a kid, child deduction. He wanted to eliminate the marriage penalty, and he talked again about accelerating those cuts in income tax rates for middle-income families. He also is going to do some favors for business. He talked about speeding up the rate at which companies can depreciate assets and investments on their taxes, particularly in capital goods. He wants to make that faster, wants to make it bigger. But the big casino here is the abolition of the tax on dividends.
Now, when details of this plan came out, they started, I guess, last Friday, but been dribbling out ever since, Democrats immediately described it as a plan that primarily benefits the rich. Throughout his speech today, the president stressed this is a plan for all Americans that we just heard in that tape clip. He stressed on the dividend taxes, this was, you know, for senior citizens. How do you read this?
Well, they're both right. Bush is trying today to make this as broad-based as he can. He talked a lot about workers. He didn't mention senior citizens as much, I thought, today as simply workers and families. He's trying to hit that hard as he can to stress that this is a broad-based program. The Democrats are saying it's broad-based in name, but not actually in the benefits it provides. And they point to the fact that only about 8% of people who file income tax returns have dividend income they actually declare. So they both sort of get points for trying to state their case.
Now, there has been a fair amount of doubt expressed already that any of these ideas or all of them taken together can actually stimulate the economy, and that suggests the question about whether there are political motives at play here.
It struck me that Bush was trying to finish the job that he began last year, which is just to keep a steady reduction in taxes across the board, not just rates, but also preferences and tax expenditures. That's something he came to office promising to do, and this is one way to look at it is, irrespective of what's going on in the economy, Neil, this is round two of the Bush tax-cutting agenda. The trick for the Democrats will be a lot of Democrats are going to support this. They're going to vote for it. They may say that this is
as many did the first time around.
Yeah, they will. They will again here too, particularly in the Senate, where the fight's going to be. So you'll hear some criticisms from Democrats, but I'm struck by actually how quiet, gentle these criticisms have been. They haven't been as vociferous as you recall from the great fights of the early 1980s when the Stockman tax plan Reagan years. Those were pitched battles compared to what I feel like I'm hearing now.
And in terms of timing, the president always stresses urgency when he sends something up to Capitol Hill. Is Congress likely to respond with urgency?
It's funny. It's a very short speech. It was barely 30 minutes, and almost as if to say, I want this done this afternoon. I suspect they're going to do it fast, but fast in Congress is measured in terms of months. And if it's done in 4 months, that, in fact, will be fast for Congress.
Well, thanks very much, Michael.
You bet, Neil.
Michael Duffy is Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, Assistant Managing Editor also for the magazine, and he spoke with us by phone from his office here in Washington. In other news today, anti-terrorist police in London say they arrested six people of North African origin after finding traces of ricin, a deadly poison that in the past has been linked to Al-Qaeda and to Iraq. Joining us now from London is Stuart Tendler, crime correspondent for The Times. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good evening.
Can you tell us what happened Sunday night?
The raids were carried out on Sunday morning at five addresses in North and East London, following an intelligence operation which began at the new year and was led by officers from MI5, which is our security service. They arrested six men and a woman at the addresses and sealed a flat in North London above a chemist shop where they found evidence of an underground laboratory.
And
they took traces of some of the chemicals in the laboratory and sent them to government scientists at a laboratory which specializes in biological and chemical warfare. And this morning, the scientists reported to the government that they had found traces of a poison called ricin, which is produced from an extraction from the castor oil seed.
And ricin is one of those poisons that I guess gained notoriety during the Cold War. There was the famous incident involving Georgi Markov on Waterloo Bridge.
That's correct. In fact, it's a poison that's been known for some time, and even the British government experimented with it in the Second World War. In 1978, Georgi Markov was stabbed in the ankle with the tip of an umbrella which had been impregnated with ricin as he was walking along Waterloo Bridge. And the attack was carried out by agents of the Bulgarian Secret Service who wanted to silence him. He had come to Britain and broadcast a number of anti-communist messages through the British World Service and other media.
Ricin, as you mentioned, is derived from castor beans. It is highly lethal.
It is. It's said to be 6,000 times more potent than cyanide, and a dosage the size of a flake of salt is capable of killing an adult man.
Hmm. What do we know, other than the fact that they're of North African origin, about these suspects?
Well, we believe that they are probably Algerian, and we think they may not have been in this country all that long. Detectives are examining the documents on which they were traveling and trying to discover if they were illegal immigrants or possibly asylum seekers. London has quite a large colony of North Africans, and there have been a number of arrests since September the 11th in the North African community by detectives.
And
we believe that they're aged from the teens to the early 30s, so they're all young men. But so far, very little else has emerged, and detectives are searching for other contacts they may have had in this country.
And is there anything so far to tie them to any organization, and specifically to Al-Qaeda?
No, there isn't anything that the police will talk about, but Al-Qaeda is known to have been looking at the production of ricin. And after the Allies, Western Allies, got into Kabul in 2001, in fact, a reporter from this newspaper, the London Times, discovered documents at a safe house used by leaders of Al-Qaeda showing that they were looking at methods of producing ricin.
Yet, as you mentioned, the British experimented with this during the Second World War, so did the United States, and it's, in this fairly exotic world, it's not that unusual a poison.
It's not, but it's not used all that widely. I mean, the Syrians and the Iraqis also thought to have stockpiled this poison. It's not an easy poison to administer. We're not talking about something like sarin, which could be spread, say, on an underground railway system. To kill somebody with an aerosol, you've got to be fairly close, and it's also got to be a high dosage. Police and security chiefs are saying today that they suspect that this sort of poison would be of use for, say, an assassination attempt against a VIP, someone like Georgi Markov, or against a small group of people. It's not a weapon of mass destruction.
At the same time, there have to be some new nerves there in London. The government has repeatedly been warning the British people that they could be targets of terrorism.
Oh, yes. We've been on alert now for over 15 months, and the Prime Minister in his New Year message warned again of the possibility that we might be targeted by terrorists. We, in the past, have been used by the Al-Qaeda group and its allies as a sort of supply area rather than an area for actual attack. But the fear in Whitehall is that that may have changed given our involvement in the hunt for Al-Qaeda and possibly even our involvement with the United States in the potential war with Iraq.
And we should note, I think, 1,500 British reservists were called to duty today in connection with that. You can often tell something about what kind of investigation is underway by identifying the various police outfits involved in the operation. What do we know about who's involved in the arrest of these men?
The lead agency on the intelligence side is MI5, the security service. The investigation is now in the hands of Special Branch at the Yard. They are, I suppose you could call them loosely, political police. It's not actually the case. They are involved in investigating intelligence on subversives, terrorists, that sort of thing. They've been a major force against the IRA in Northern Ireland. And the actual investigative questioning is now in the hands of the anti-terrorist branch, which has got a very long history in this in London. It was formed in the early 1970s when the IRA first began their attacks here. They've investigated quite a lot of Middle East terrorism in the last 30 years because London has been the cockpit for a number of fights and assassinations. We'll also be using a lot of forensic science work as well because there'll be a great deal of interest in finding out who used the flat where the laboratory was found, what can be discovered from the equipment that was discovered there, where it was bought, who might have bought it. All that sort of work will be going on. In fact, it's likely to take the scientists some time to clear out this one-bedroom flat to make sure they've got all the clues.
And is there any further information you can give us on the tip that led the special branch and MI5 to these men?
No, the police and MI5 are giving away absolutely nothing on that today. But, I mean, there is wide-ranging international cooperation these days, especially in this area. We cooperate very closely with the French, Dutch, Germans, and Belgians, and Italians as well, all of whom have had arrests, have seen arrests since September the 11th. And, of course, there's a large FBI presence in London. Some FBI agents now working full-time at the Yard alongside the counter-terrorist officers.
Well, we know you're on deadline there, and we thank you very much for taking the time out to speak with us today.
Okay. Thanks very much indeed.
Okay. Stuart Tendler is crime correspondent for The Times, which, of course, is published in London, and he joined us by phone from London. When we return from a short break, we'll take a look at a group of people on the front lines of American diplomacy abroad. What is it like to be an American ambassador during a time of terrorism? And we'll, of course, welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. How do diplomats do their job? Have you ever used the services of an embassy when you're traveling abroad? Back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We now turn to the work of ambassadors overseas at this time of great turmoil and unrest. In these days of terrorism with global reach, the foreign policy of the United States centers around security, backed by diplomacy. Among many other jobs, ambassadors are charged to help protect American interests overseas and ensure that Americans abroad are safe, a difficult task at the best of times, increasingly difficult over the past few years. What is it like to represent the United States, and particularly at a time of unrest? What makes a great ambassador? An accident of history, training, or is it performance? And how do you deliver a stiff protest to a foreign leader, or receive one? How does a person prepare to become an ambassador? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Thomas Simmons, a visiting diplomatic scholar at Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts, formerly ambassador to Poland and Pakistan. He is at the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Ambassador Simmons, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Neil, it's Simons, but I answer to almost anything. I'm happy to be on the program.
Well, you spell it Simmons, so I apologize for that. And let's also introduce to our listeners James Lilly, and I think I got that one right. He's with us here in Studio 3A, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a former ambassador to China, South Korea, and Taiwan. Ambassador Lilly, good to have you back on the show.
Fine. Thank you.
You're both retired from service overseas, but as you look around in today's environment, would you agree that it's a difficult time for to be an ambassador of the United States, Thomas Simmons?
Well, I think it was never easy. I think it has gotten more difficult because of the direct danger to the people that you are managing and supervising and to the Americans in country. On the other hand, you have an honor roll in the vestibule of the State Department in Washington, which goes back to the beginning of the Republic, and half of it is since 1967. Hmm. In Pakistan, we had people killed in March of 95, even before I got there. So we were so secure that I think the people going after Americans started going after others. We lost businessmen in November of 97. So this was well before the attack on the embassies in East Africa. One of the reasons I think maybe they went to East Africa was because we were so screwed down. But just to say that it's not a new problem, it's not one since 9/11, but of course it's become more serious since 9/11. But it's still great work.
Ambassador Lilly, how much of an ambassador's time is spent worrying about security?
Well, I think it depends on the place. I served in three areas, one Taipei, Taiwan, as half an ambassador. I served in Seoul and then in Beijing during Tiananmen. Security is handled by the security officer. He reports directly to you, at least in the cases I had. And I found usually they were pretty much on top of the situation. In Seoul, we had constant threats coming from mobs that would be anti-American mobs that would cover our fence and get down and cause disruption, burn an American flag or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
These were fairly easy to handle. You could pick them up by the scruff of the neck and throw them out in the street. At least the Korean police would do that, let them in to do it. And it was manageable. In Beijing, we had to spend quite a bit of time on security during my tour there for two reasons. One is we had a dissident in the embassy who the Chinese had sentenced to death and they wanted to get access to. That was one main reason. And the other reason was that we had Tiananmen Square happen, where there was bullets flying and our own dependents were endangered. It turns out that nobody was killed, but nevertheless, people panicked in this situation. So I say during certain times I had to spend 70-80% of my time on it, then I'd go for weeks without spending much time on it, just getting reports from the security officer. And then something else would come on, and you go into 40-50% of your time.
Yeah. Thomas Simons, you know, obviously we focus on moments of great drama and danger, such as Tiananmen Square, as Ambassador Lilly mentioned. But is there any such thing as a typical day for an ambassador?
Well, I think probably it may vary. I think there probably is a typical day because the basic functions of an ambassador and an embassy are fairly constant. I mean, it's accurately representing American views to the government that you're accredited to and to the people of that society. It's reporting on them back to Washington. It's trying to influence U.S. policy for the better in the gentlest possible way, because who likes to be told if you're in Washington? It's taking care of these embassy families, and as Ambassador Lilly says, that depends on the country. I mean, police states, you're safer than in places where you have soft states, which was somewhat the case in Pakistan, taking care of Americans in those countries, and then supervising embassies that typically have six or seven or eight agencies represented on behalf of the president. Those are the kinds of things, and you get up in the morning, you read traffic, you read papers, you have a series of meetings, and you try to direct the work of my missions were both about 150 officers each in the directions that I've suggested, and also to keep their morale up. I mean, to give them a sense of why they're doing this difficult work in these remote and sometimes dangerous places.
Mm-hmm. Our telephone number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we go to Rita, who's on the line with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi.
Hi.
I have lived abroad for many years in different countries, mostly all of them were third world countries. And many of them, of course, as typical in those places, you know, there were, it was iffy whether or not there might be in-country political troubles.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them anti-American sentiment. So we discussed this, the expatriate community in these places discussed this, and we said, if any problem ever arises, we will go to the British Embassy for help. We will not go to the U.S. Embassy. Because it was some people had been in places where they had tried to get help at the American embassy and they couldn't. If there was a problem in the country, the attitude of the Americans was, get yourself out the best way you can. We can't do anything for you.
Mm-hmm.
But the British, I think there was a famous case maybe in North Africa somewhere where there was bad in-country trouble and. They all got in a convoy with the Brits because the American embassy would do nothing. And there were other incidents like that that I can't remember right at the moment. But
you're suggesting you had little faith in the willingness or the ability of the American diplomats to help you?
Zero.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't waste my time on a trip to the American embassy if I was in a foreign country and there was in-country trouble.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Lilly, get a response? We're not talking about you specifically, but in general.
Well, I think you do get this attitude from the part of the American public. I can say that during Tiananmen, when there was a major crisis and we had thousands and thousands upon Americans in Tianjin, in surrounding areas, that we had to get out. It was a major logistics operation, getting buses, getting these people money because most of them were broke students, corralling them on our embassy grounds, getting them out. Every single one of them got out, chartering airplanes to get them out, putting your key men on watch to get them through roadblocks or to get them food and supplies. We did all of this. It was a 24-hour deal. And yet I can say that there were always disgruntled Americans who would land in Tokyo or land in San Francisco and say what exactly this questioner said. Mm-hmm. The embassy did nothing for me. And we helped thousands of people get out. And it was a very tough job. We had our own convoys.
I had jewelry with me all the time. I had gold on me all the time because I would never imagine that I could get help from the American embassy, and I thought I could bribe a seat, at least for my children, with that jewelry.
Well, let me just say there's another world outside of you, and there's very different things that happen in areas that don't conform with what you just said. If you talk to people in Beijing, you'll sure get the person that will snarl at the American embassy. They don't like you. They never liked you when they went there, and they would take any advantage to give you a hard time. And the press always looks for some sort of an indication that the American official establishment is screwed up. But all I can say is we worked our heads off night and day, and there were real heroes in the American embassy. I wrote the president about them. The terrific
work. Well, I'm
really
glad to hear that. You know, I would have never known it from personal experience.
Well, yeah, I think you went to the wrong places. The military attaché was superb. In what he did. He ran roadblocks, he bribed people, he reported what had happened. The public affairs officer handled the media as best he could, but he deserved a star. And the wonderful secretary I had on work 20 hours a day, handling 2,000-3,000 phone calls a day, pouring in on us. something from Lubbock, Texas. Where is Sonny Boy? You people haven't told me where he is. It turns out he's in the next city. He got out 10 days ago. I mean, you get all kinds of questions coming in from all over the world, and you've got to manage them.
Yep. Rita, we're not going to resolve this, but thanks very much for your call.
Let me tell you one thing.
Okay.
I'm from Texas, and that's not Lubbock, it's Lubbock.
Well, if I can be corrected in my pronunciation, surely the ambassador can as well. Thanks very much, Rita.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Casey, who's with us, it says, from the Bay Area in California.
Hi, Neil. I have a question for Ambassador Simon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ambassador, this is about Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the generals in Pakistan, and no matter whether they're exporting terrorism or they're exporting nuclear technology, seem to be getting away with a lot of things. They're very adept at telling the Americans exactly what the Americans want to hear, and then go and do precisely the opposite. Are we missing something in terms of appropriate American reaction to these digressors from Pakistan?
I think they're about as good as the elected civilian governments before them in telling the Americans what they wanted to hear. And I think the Americans are pretty alive to the difficulties and the dilemmas of relations with a country like Pakistan, whether it's under military government or under elected government. I think the governments themselves are conflicted as to how much they can afford politically to crack down on these Islamist extremists who are a force. I think they're not a majority force, but they're an important force in that society. So they can't do everything that the Americans wish them to do. And on the nuclear side, Pakistanis feel that they need a nuclear deterrent, even though it's not something the United States wants. I think the relations with North Korea are deplorable and potentially dangerous, but I also understand why in a situation where India is superior by 8 and 9 and 10 to 1, and the relationship has been hostile for over 50 years, why Pakistan feels it needs help with technology, which it's not going to get anywhere else in the world. So it's going to be an ambiguous situation. It always has been. It remains that today. But I think Pakistan has come a long way in partnership with us since 9/11 to muster the courage to crack down on these extremist elements, even though it hasn't gone all the way. And I think we need to keep a relationship with them to keep them moving in that direction. I think that's in the national interest, but it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be black and white.
Casey, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. We're speaking with former ambassadors Thomas Simons and James Lilly about their very difficult previous jobs, that of being the American ambassador. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's go to Terry, who's on the line with us from Detroit.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A quick question for both the ambassadors. I recently applied this past fall to the Foreign Service, along with, I believe, around about 30,000 other U.S. citizens or Americans. And my question for you is this. In order to reach the position of ambassador, it's my understanding that you have to be affiliated with a political party, the Republican or Democrat. Is this true, or can you reach this position through the Foreign Service via your merits alone?
Ambassador Lilly?
Well, I think the ratio of career ambassadors, that's where people come in as low-level Foreign Service officers, work their way up, runs somewhere between 60 and 70%. And probably 20 to 30% are appointees. Obviously, they're appointees from the party that won the election. I was an appointee in all three places I went to. But we had, if you go back over East Asia today, you have about, I'd say 60% of the ambassadors in East Asia are career men.
And what party they belong to is irrelevant.
Irrelevant.
Yes.
I was a career ambassador. I came in 1963. John Kennedy signed my first commission. My dad came in 1945. I think maybe the percentage of politicals has gotten a little higher as the years have passed, regardless of party, as a function of democratization. I mean, it's harder and harder for Americans to realize that a long apprenticeship helps. I think more and more Americans feel that if you do one thing well, you should be able to do anything well, that if you can sell real estate, you ought to be able to be an ambassador. But, and perhaps the proportion of political people is higher in Europe than it is in East Asia. But in general, some of our best ambassadors have been political, and I think the career service really judges them on performance, and the performance has been superlative in many cases, weak as it has been for career people in some, but generally the country has been well served. But you certainly don't need to be political to be an ambassador. Look at me.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Terry. Ambassador Lilly, I wanted to ask you, what's it like to be sitting outside the office of, you know, the chairman of the Communist Party or somebody like that, and with a stiff message in your hand from Washington, and knowing you've got to go in there and basically yell at a foreign leader?
Well, well, first you don't yell. You carry through your message, and sometimes you can do a little creative embellishment. I think probably one of the toughest times I had was in Korea when I had to go in and tell the president, who was a former four-star general, that if he used the troops to crush the movement, the popular movements in Korea, we would take a very dim view of that. And I back that up with some specifics, which I won't go into.
Mm-hmm.
It was a gamble, because previously he'd gone in Gwangju about 8 years, 7 years earlier, and had slaughtered 2,000 people. This was the same man. But this time, he held his fire. I think his own generals heard what had happened and said, don't do it. And you don't get nasty with them. I don't think that's the way to do it. You can be firm. You can be tough. You've got to be very clear. And you've got to get your message across. And I think you've got to have feedback how your message went over. And our good, we have collaborators who tell us how it went.
Mm-hmm.
And this one happened to work out. I can think of some other cases where it didn't work so well, where in China I tried to get to the leadership and tell them to go slow at Tiananmen, do not resort to force. What the Chinese did is to pull back, and the only people I could see were the foreign ministry. Well, they didn't have the clout.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to give the messages from President Bush or from Secretary Baker to the foreign ministry delegate. But that didn't work that second time.
Well, Ambassador Lilly, thanks very much for joining us today. James Lilly is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a former ambassador to China, South Korea, and, as he mentioned, half an ambassador to Taiwan. He was with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, what former ambassadors teach aspiring diplomats. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, we're talking about ambassadors and international diplomacy. Our guest is former Ambassador Thomas Simons, now a visiting scholar at Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Foreign Service personnel are trained at the Foreign Service Institute here in Washington, D.C., and joining us now is one of the instructors at that school, former Ambassador Prudence Bushnell. She's dean of the School of Leadership and Management at the Foreign Service Institute, also former ambassador to Guatemala and Kenya. Madam Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You were, I guess everybody remembers, ambassador in Kenya when the terrorists struck the embassy there in August 1998. When you think back on that attack, what do you remember?
Good heavens. I remember things in great detail. I think the people who go through extraordinary events have the sensation that time slows down and the event itself stays in your mind. The time after fast forwards and one recalls less detail. But I certainly remember the moment I heard the noise and walked to the window and then the explosion happened. I certainly remember seeing my embassy as a burning hulk.
Thomas Simons, you were in Poland in difficult times, but nothing like that.
Well, that's right. I mean, Poland, although I can remember my first tour in Poland, which was in the late 60s and early 70s, the first attack on a Jordanian diplomat, it would have been in the spring of 71 after Black September, after King Hussein crushed a PLO uprising, and how shocked we were that it could possibly happen in a communist state, which, among other things, is a police state. And there was some deterioration in the police power after the fall of communism when I was there from 90 to 93, but never to the point where we felt in danger. And since then, it's consolidated itself. The problem is in Pakistan, where I was after the attack on Ambassador Bushnell's embassy, when we picked up, or the Pakistani, our police picked up, one of the perpetrators trying to get to Afghanistan. We negotiated the shipping back. But after that, I had to pull down two-thirds of my embassy and send them home in anticipation of an event which no one would tell me was going to happen, which was the retaliation. In other words, I had to send 180 people home on a chartered plane without being able to tell them why I was doing it. I mean, we cooked up some worldwide terrorist thing, but I had to have a town meeting where I was explaining to other Americans why we were taking out the official Americans and not school teachers, for instance, some of whom had been evacuated after the Gulf War. So it becomes very complicated and messy. But we all believe that Ambassador Bushnell and her staff, Kenyan and American, were heroes over there, and our hearts were certainly with them.
You know, it is a reality, Ambassador Simons talks about, that ambassadors are living through even as we speak. For all of the glamour, for all of the honor, and for all of the huge amount of fun one can have as ambassador, the reality, particularly these days, is that you are responsible for the lives of your people. You are responsible for America, the safety of American citizens in your country. And these days, it is extraordinarily dangerous, not just from terrorist attacks, but criminals, increased crime, ethnic conflict. And so the role of an ambassador, I think, has changed dramatically over the years.
As you now take on the role of teaching people who may be future ambassadors, given all of that, what do you tell them?
We are increasingly, in the 2 weeks that we have to prepare people for the role of ambassador, we are increasingly focusing on the issues of leadership, their responsibilities as leaders, and on issues of crisis management and security and safety of the personnel. It's, as I say, it's a new world we live in, and the ambassador's role has changed just as other people's roles have changed.
Our phone number again is 800-989-8255. Let's go to Angelia, who's with us from Spearfish, South Dakota, unless I've mispronounced your name. I apologize if I did.
No, that was great.
Okay.
Good afternoon, ambassadors. My question for you is, if each of you had one piece of advice that you could give for success or survival in the diplomatic service that you had to learn yourselves from experience, what would that be? And the reason that I'm asking is that I am currently a candidate in the Foreign Service and coming up to some very crucial steps here. And I just would like to know what you would say you had to learn to be successful in the diplomatic service.
Ambassador Bushnell, why don't you go first?
My piece of advice would be listen. Listen before you speak.
And Ambassador Simons?
Never underestimate the importance of courage. Courage is a virtue that's hard to teach. Most people have it. It needs to be cultivated.
And both of those things are, you know, wise things to bear in mind, but what brought them to mind? Ambassador Simons, what brings courage to
mind? Well, the Foreign Service is part of a large government. We all work for the president. We're in the executive branch. It is a country where the sources of authority in foreign affairs are proliferating. So I think it's easy to get routinized and maybe even a little cynical about how difficult it is to change things for the better. My experience is that you're not looking for fights. You're not looking to be a stormy petrel or a hero. You're just looking as a citizen. It's one of the few places in America where you can still be a citizen and change your children's destiny for the better. But you have to keep working at it. Standing up, and you have to be courageous about it, not in any foolish way, but consistently.
And Ambassador Bushnell, listen before you speak. Is that hard-won wisdom?
That's hard-won wisdom, I think, for anybody. An ambassador has to lead and influence. And if you're going to influence, it's very helpful if you understand what other people are thinking, what other people are saying, how other people are feeling, and the way to do that is to listen. If I can use this opportunity, however, my first advice is for people to take the Foreign Service exam. The woman with whom we're speaking has already done that.
Right.
But if I can take advantage of this time to tell your listeners that on April 12th of this year, we have another written exam that's going to take place, and if people can go on to www.careers.state.gov. They can begin to register online by the end of this week and have an enormous career in front of them of great interest and great service.
www.careers.state.gov?
That's correct.
Okay. Angelia, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
We have a question on email for you, Ambassador Bushnell. I am from Kenya, writes Sumit, and live here now. My family volunteered during the attacks on the embassies. Nonetheless, there's been growing dissatisfaction with U.S. foreign policy, and it makes the U.S. a target. Embassies focus to therefore be reactive to mishaps and very cautious. I believe this is mainly due to a level of misunderstanding of the United States, as people are misinformed. What programs are there in place to be proactive in providing local people of a country a better understanding of the U.S.?
I think that ambassadors and other people in the mission are increasingly getting out from behind the walls. We have always had, the United States has always had very active intercultural exchanges. Increasingly, it's important to communicate to host country people through their media, and in fact, 2 days of the two-week training we have for ambassadors going out is devoted exclusively to media, television, radios, giving presentation. We in the United States, our policies have been very successful in promoting democracies overseas. Having had that success, we now have to reach out to the people of other countries because their governments aren't going to take actions unless there's public approval behind it. So we have an increasing chore task, as the woman who wrote the email noted, to influence public opinion. And that adds a whole new layer and complexity to the skills we need from our ambassadors.
Ambassador Bushnell, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Ambassador Prudence Bushnell spoke to us by phone from her office in Arlington, Virginia. She's a former U.S. ambassador in Guatemala and Kenya, and was also featured in a National Geographic documentary program, Ambassadors Under Fire, which aired on PBS last September. And Ambassador Simons, thank you for bearing up under my mispronunciation.
It was a great pleasure.
Ambassador Thomas Simons is a visiting diplomatic scholar at Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts, formerly ambassador to Poland and Pakistan. He was with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.